accession number 18708, Reel 2.
So, I mean, what sort of things did you manage to see on some of these trips?
Not really. Not very much of significance. One could really alert people to the activity that the airfield was an active airfield, because the Russians tended to move their squadrons around fairly frequently, and you could find an empty airfield, and the next time you went up it was full. Whether they were rotating squadrons from Russia or not, I don't know, but
you could identify the types on the ground and so on.
Yes.
You've learnt the shapes.
Well, I don't know that I was particularly good on that, but yes, I used to say what was there, whether it was any use at all. I doubt, really, because I suspect the proper intelligence people knew all about it, but it was a matter of perhaps confirmation of what they already knew.
Were you doing this flying when the Berlin airlift started?
Well, yes. It depends when the Berlin airlift started. It is recorded as starting on the 24th of June. But in point of fact... 1948. That's right. One was very aware of the fact that the Russians were unhappy with having the Allies, the Americans and the British, in Berlin, and indeed they were very unhappy that, in point of fact, they had got the poorer part of Germany, and that the Ruhr was very much in our hands, and it was fairly obvious that they wanted us out of Berlin. And there was, politically, one was aware that they were doing all that they could to make life very difficult for us. I'm not au fait with the actual political situation until, on the 16th of June, the Russians walked out of the Kommandatoria, which was the military council which was running Berlin at the time, and it was fairly obvious that something drastic was going to happen. I was actually doing a run to Bückeburg and Gatto on the 17th, just a normal run, and it was on the 18th of June that the Soviet military administration closed all traffic, and they started searching everything, and it was quite impossible to move. And it was as I returned from my scheduled trip that I just spoke of, on the Saturday I returned to Oakington, and I was met by the squadron commander, who said, "You're going back into Germany, there's trouble. They've closed all the borders, and you and one other aircraft are going back to Bückeburg to augment the Anson that runs from Bückeburg into Berlin on a daily basis, to keep communications going, not only freight but VIPs, both German and military personnel." So I actually started on that day, I was doing that when the Berlin airlift, Carter-Patterson it was called initially, actually started on the 24th, and I continued on the Berlin airlift until the August the following year. Having completed the task from Bückeburg, we then went into Wunsdorf with the whole of the squadron, with the whole of the Dakota force. I think there was something like 48 Dakotas in Wunsdorf at the time. It was an interesting time because it was organized chaos. if that's not a the airfield was a fighter airfield. It had no hard standings or anything like that, and heavy aircraft were just parked on the grass, and it soon became a quagmire. They posted in an army unit of a captain, a staff sergeant and 20 soldiers to load 48 aircraft, which clearly was quite impossible. They brought in, eventually, local civilians to help load the aircraft. The ground crew had arrived, and it was just a matter of using what facilities were available to get the aircraft ready and loaded. The accommodation was, in point of fact, non-existent. There was an officer's mess, but with 48 crews of a four-man crew for each one, there just weren't enough beds. I seem to recall that I slept on the billiard table for the first night that I was there. Eventually, I found a palliasse up in the attic, and I used to sleep in there, a large dormitory where I suppose there must have been nearly 50 of us sleeping in the attic, all sleeping at different times because there was no organisation as such. What we used to do was to go down onto the flight line, go to the maintenance huts to see whether there was a serviceable aircraft, and if there was a serviceable aircraft that had got a load on it, then you just used to walk out and take it and fly into Berlin and come back. And this you used to do for the rest of the day.
How many sorties would you get through in one day?
Well, it was normal to do about three. I suppose I tended to be a little keen in those days, and I remember flying four, which meant that you were flying about a 20-hour day. And because you couldn't get much rest with 50 people around you at any one time, that was the pattern of things for about the first fortnight or so.
So when you'd come back from one sortie, you'd be given another fully loaded aircraft, you'd just get into it and go.
Well, you weren't given it, you just walked to the flight hut and said, is there another one available? And literally, you flew as much or as little as you wanted to, and when you felt tired, you said, well, that's enough for the day, and I'm a bit hungry, by the way. I think I better go and get some food. And this carried on for about the first three, maybe, you know, I was going to say 4 weeks. I don't think it was 4 weeks. But then the rest of Transport Command was mobilised, and the Yorks came in. And of course, being heavier, it caused absolute chaos. They couldn't possibly cope with Yorks and Dakotas. And we were moved off to Fassberg, which was another Luftwaffe station. It turned out to be, because they knew that we were going there, they were able to organise things much better. They had a rail link with outside, and I think they had about 10 or even 12 sidings in which they were bringing trains in 24 hours a day, loaded with coal. They organised the local labour force, and there must have been about 6,000 of them there, who were taking the coal out of trucks and loading them into what I would call hundredweight bags so that they could be manhandled by one man. We moved to Fassberg, and we ran coal from Fassberg into Gatow, doing nothing else at all. It was a very dusty job, as you would expect. By this time, we had the pattern of flying had changed to a matter of routine. We used to fly in shifts, therefore you knew exactly when you were going to fly, and by and large we used to do 2 sorties a day. And it used to work that your day was a 20-hour day, that is, you used to have 12 hours flying, or 12 hours on duty, and 12 hours off duty. I'm sorry, 10 hours, I make a mistake, 10 hours flying, 10 hours off duty. Therefore, your day came forward by 4 hours every day. So if you had breakfast at 8 o'clock on day 1, then you're going to have it at 4 o'clock the following day, and at midnight on the following day. And that was the pattern that you used to do, and you used to do this for 7 days. And
so
then
you'd fly day and night, would you?
Oh, yes. Mm. You'd just fly all the time. And then you had a day off every 7th day, and every 15th day you went home to England for a 48-hour pass. And therefore, it became a matter of routine. The problem with eating was a problem, because you never knew what meal you were supposed to be eating, and certainly it became difficult. And then the Americans came into it in force, and they only had Frankfurt Romain in the south, and it was a longer haul for them into Berlin. So they actually came up to Fassburg and took over from us, and the Dakotas then moved up to Lübeck on the border with the Russian zone in the north. And the same procedure continued for when we were at Lübeck. We, 46th Squadron, lived in an outstation called St. Hubertus, which was good. It was about 5 miles down the road from Lübeck, which meant to say you got away from the normal military station. But the pattern of flying from then on to the end of the airlift was this 10-hour day, 10 hours on, 10 hours off, and creeping forward all the time.
Presumably, on each sortie, you just took enough fuel to get there and back. You didn't want to overload the kind of the aircraft.
No, that's right. They were fueled to do the round trip. We used to fly in slots. You would have the Yorks going up, occupying say an hour, followed by another hour of Yorks, followed by another hour of Skymasters, followed by an hour of Dakotas, and so forth, flying at different levels. But all those of us that were going into Gatow, we had to make for the Frano beacon, which was just north of Gatow. And you had to arrive at the Frano beacon within a minute of the prescribed time.
So you had a stopwatch in the cockpit?
Well, literally, it was a navigational trip, which you had to fly within the corridors prescribed by the Russians.
How did you do that? Because the corridors are very narrow, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
You just flew on this beacon, did you?
No, we used to fly on G.
On G again?
Still using G. But you had the directional radio compass, which, when you got within 50 miles of the beacon, you could head for the beacon, and you used to report over the beacon, and then you used to be taken in, depending upon the weather. It might be a visual landing, which a lot of them were. But on the other hand, the cloud base could be down to 200 feet, in which case you were monitored in on the ground controlled approach.
That's the sort of talk down, isn't it?
That's the talk down. And we used to land, depending on the weather. Every 2 minutes, we used to land if we were doing visual landings. If we were being talked down, it used to go out to 4 minutes. I seem to recall. But there were occasions. I remember when we were in the spring of the following year, when we were making a political point to the Russians that we could go on as long as they liked, that we were actually landing every minute, which meant to say that you had an aircraft actually landed on the runway just turning off, one aircraft actually with its wheels touching the beginning of the runway, and another aircraft about 3 miles back on the approach, which didn't really give you any chance of misjudgment. If you did, you had to go round again and go home. In fact, this was a practice throughout the whole thing. If you didn't make your approach and land, you went back with your full load, because there was no way that you could be slotted in again.
And they had to also slot in a returning aircraft, presumably.
Oh yes. So when we're talking about landing every 2 minutes, there's one taking off in between those. Mm. So the actual.
And you didn't have parallel runways like that.
Oh no. Yeah. And during that time, they made another runway and it lengthened the runway. It was a very short runway at initially at Gatow. Mm. It was the PSP runway on, which is planking on grass. Mm. And they actually built a runway, and all the materials had to be brought in, the tar and things like that, to make macadam and so forth. It was a very interesting time, because you actually, the economists had to decide what you were going to take in. Boneless meat had to be taken in. You didn't take the bones in. You took real coffee rather than ersatz coffee in, because it produced more coffee at the other end. All these things were sorted out. On the return trips, the Yorks and the Skymasters, yes, used to fly back empty in the main, but the Dakotas being a little more flexible, we used to bring out the children and the elderly, which was a very interesting exercise.
Well, they'd go and stay with relatives or something? Or?
Yes, either stay with relatives, or if it was a matter of a medical problem, then they would be brought out to go into hospital, because there were no facilities in Berlin for major operations or anything like that. So we were bringing children out, which was really, in a way, terribly sad, because you get a load of children, about 30, with one adult, and you would take them out and take them back to Lübeck. But you could get to Lübeck, and the civilian administration didn't necessarily come and pick them up from the aircraft. So you had these children who were probably being terribly sick all over the aircraft, and you used to have to wait for them to be cleared. Well, you felt that you had to wait for them to be cleared. So we had a lot of contact with the civilians and bringing them out. Of course, during this time, we were taking in raw material so that the Berliners themselves could manufacture stuff. And they were being brought out by us, and indeed by the Yorks.
Manufactured
goods. To keep the economy...
Raw materials would you take in?
Well, we were taking in steel plates, things like that, and in fact there's a notorious case where steel plates were loaded onto a Dakota, which was supposed to go onto a York, and it was not surprising that the pilot had some difficulty getting off the end of the runway at Wunstorf at the time. This is when I was speaking about the chaos that was going on with the loading, and indeed the German labour force were not unknown to back a truck into the back of the aircraft and make it US unserviceable by putting a great big dent in the fuselage. Well,
accidentally.
Oh yes, accidentally. Yeah, they just weren't skilled.
Yeah.
Eventually, it all righted itself, and it was all highly organised. And one could have gone on and literally for years. It was expensive, but nevertheless, it could have gone on. There really was no problem having sorted everything out.
Did you have much contact with the labour or with local Germans at that time? I mean, the fraternisation laws had been relaxed, presumably.
Yes. No, I didn't have very much. I had a fair, perhaps more than the people on the airlift, contact with Germans, because having been doing the domestic runs, the diplomatic runs and so forth, for 2 years, I knew an awful lot of the workers at Gatow at the time, and therefore I used to go into Berlin and have a coffee or something like that, and therefore knew them not very closely, of course. And on the airlift itself, it was so organised that you used to land, a lorry used to back up to the back of the Dakota, and a shift of about eight labourers used to unload it just in time for you to get out and perhaps have a cup of coffee in the Malcolm Club, which was actually on the hard standing there. But we got it down to such a fine art, and it was so quick that I didn't bother in the latter part of the airlift of going in and having a coffee. I used to have a rug that I used to make and I used to sit in the aircraft and continue to make this rug, because you were only on the ground for about 20 minutes.
You stopped your engines, presumably.
Oh yes. Stop the engine and just wait for them to unload, and load up perhaps with children before it was time to take off again. I suppose I should mention, since at the beginning of the airlift there was the accident with the British European Airways and a Yak aircraft that crashed into it, that we were buzzed. We were buzzed by the Yak aircraft in the corridors to try and make life unpleasant for us. And one was supposed to just fly down a straight line down the corridor and ignore them. But I found it very tiresome, and one particular Russian pilot buzzed me twice and got a bit too close on the second occasion. And when he came round for the third run, I decided that I'd had enough, and I turned the aircraft into him. And it was just a matter of chicken, who's going to opt out first, and luckily he did. And I never saw another Yak in the whole of my time on the airlift.
Do you think that's what happened in that fatal collision?
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure. They just got too close. I mentioned earlier on that a flight refueling aircraft came down in the Russian zone, and I was a member of the Board of Inquiry that went into the Russian zone. We went in with a Queen Mary low loader vehicle to pick up the aircraft. We went in with a crane that was going to pick the aircraft up, a lorry with the ground crew that were going to do the job, and a staff car which we were in. And of course they had RAF roundels on them all. And the tragic thing I found, that as we went through the villages the villagers all turned out thinking that we were coming to liberate them. And it was a very sad sight when it was obviously explained by the interpreter to them that we were just coming in for the day.
Now, this was in the Russian-occupied zone anyway, and yeah. Well away from presumably any corridor.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Well,
did you have a Russian escort?
Yes, we were shadowed all the time. And when we were actually in the area, and the commissar, or whatever you called him, was responsible for our movements, we actually had three full Russian colonels with each one of us all the time. I remember that when it was all over, we were invited to have some schnapps with them in the evening, and we were having schnapps and cold something fish, which I didn't enjoy one little bit, and we were having toasts after toasts, and suddenly one realized that the colonel on your left would propose a toast and down the schnapps. And then the colonel on the right would propose a toast and down the schnapps, and it soon became apparent that they were drinking one to our two. We soon realised that and got them in a happy mood as well. And I don't drink very much, but I was determined to stay upright, and when we left at 10 o'clock at night, we had won the day, as it were. We went outside into the cold, into the staff car, and that's the last I remember until I was in bed.
So, the Berlin airlift, you know, once it got going, and you said they could have gone on forever, you know, even though it was very expensive, were you aware that you were getting very tired?
Initially, in the first 4 weeks, the answer is yes. But when it became organised, no. It became a matter of routine. One got established in this 10-hour day working and 10-hour off and coming home every 15 days for a 48 hour. It became a matter of routine. In a way, rather boring routine, but nevertheless it was easy to run, and one was aware. One of the things that I didn't mention, of course, was that the weather played a major part, and the delight of it all was that you had these airfields, southern Germany, midwestern Germany, and we up in the north, and it was possible, and you could do the changes according to the weather, so that you could have Wunsdorf would suddenly go out in fog, and although we up in Lübeck were only due, shall we say, to take two shifts that day, the mere fact that Wunsdorf had gone out suddenly, you had to bring in extra crews. And the Dakotas would be doing all the running because of fog in the south, so it was infinitely flexible. Clearly the Skymasters and the Yorks were bringing in more than the Dakotas, so therefore the Dakotas could be stood down if the serviceability states were in favour of the Yorks running. So, although I say it was routine, it was infinitely flexible, and this was why it was so successful.